Ephesians chapter 5 verses 15 to 20, the 18th talk in a series on Ephesians, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 18, 2018 at Reformation Fellowship.
The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Handout number 11, translation, installment 9, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we continue our study in the book of Ephesians. I'm going to back up and just read as a way of reviewing. In this letter, he said that we need to walk in a manner that is fitting to the calling to which we have been called. And that's the theme of the entire letter. And as we will see here at the end, the righteousness that he's calling us to, what's the rationale for calling us to righteousness? Because that's what we've been called to. He has this vision of what kind of human being God is going to turn us into. And that's what he calls the new man. And because that's what we've been called to, his exhortation right now is to put on the new man, that is, own this new vision of what kind of person I'm going to be and pursue becoming that person even now in this life. So we have a whole section here that we're in the middle of where the exhortation is to be righteous. It's an exhortation to righteous conduct, but it's all predicated on the fact that why are we called to righteous conduct? Why are we exhorted to righteous conduct? Because a righteous person is what I'm going to be one day. That's what I've been called to. So I'm going to read this whole section that we've been going over right up to where we left off, and that will serve as our review here. I'm starting in chapter 4, verse 17, which is paragraph 21 on my translation. So then, I will state and affirm this, as individuals who belong to the Lord, you are no longer to walk as the Gentiles walk, in the unfruitfulness of their mind, being darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life offered by God because of the ignorance that is in them on account of the obdurate hardness of their heart. These Gentiles, being beyond any sense of shame, have given themselves over to unrestrained sexual desire such that in their pleonexia they engage in every sort of sexually impure practice. But with regard to following the Messiah, this is not what you learned, if in fact you have given heed to him and have been taught by him. Such is the truth with regard to Jesus, that with reference to your former way of life, you take off the old person, who in the nature of deceitful desires was proceeding to destruction, and be made new in the spirit of your mind, and clothe yourself with the new person, the one who, in accord with the purposes of God, is created for righteousness and a true devotion to God. Therefore, laying aside the lie, affirm the truth, each one of you with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Be angered, but do not sin. The sun is not to go down on your indignation. Do not give place to the diabolos. The one who steals is to steal no longer. Rather, he is to labor, producing with his own hands some good thing so that he has something to share with one who has a need. No worthless counsel is to come out of your mouth. Rather, only if something is good for the building up that is needed, so that it gives grace to those who hear. Do not bring grief to the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of your liberation. Every occurrence of bitterness and rage and anger and loud quarreling and name-calling is to be put away from you, along with every occurrence of malice. Rather, be kind to one another, tender-hearted, showing grace to each other, just as God in Christ has also shown grace to you. Therefore, as beloved children, be imitators of God and walk in love, even as the Messiah loved us and gave himself up as an offering and sacrifice to God for us to be a fragrant aroma. Now, as is fitting for the Hagioi, sexual immorality, along with every form of sexual impurity, is not to be named among you, neither should pleonexia. Furthermore, talk about sex that is shameful and makes light of it, or makes a mockery of it, these things are not appropriate. Rather, on the contrary, there is to be a giving of thanks. Now, know and understand this, that no sexually immoral person or sexually impure person or pleonectes, who is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of the Messiah and God. No one is to deceive you with empty arguments, for because of these things the wrath of God is upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not be co-participants with them. Now back then you were darkness, but now in the Lord you are light. Walk as children of light. Now the fruit of the light consists in all the ways goodness and righteousness and truth manifest themselves, judging to be good what is pleasing to the Lord. And do not share in common with them the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but in fact rather show them that they are wrong. The things done by them in secret are shameful even to describe. Now, the all, the whole entire people of God, now the all become manifest when they are shown to be wrong by the light. Indeed, each individual who becomes manifest is light. That is why it says, wake up, sleep ahead, get up from the dead, and the Messiah will be shining on you. Okay, now we come to paragraph 30, which is we want to begin with today. So then, watch how meticulously you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise men, buying up the time, because the days are evil. Because of this, do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Indeed, do not get drunk with wine, for that is a squandering of one's life. Rather, be filled by the Spirit, so that you are expressing yourselves in spiritual psalms and hymns and songs as you sing and make melody in your heart to the Lord, by always giving thanks for all things to the God and Father in the name of our Lord Jesus, the Messiah. Okay, so in this, the structure of this last section, or this section that we've looked at, is he's come to a point where he's exhorting them to righteous conduct. He begins by saying, leave your former life behind. You used to live as a debauched Gentile, living in a sea of debauched Gentiles. And you went to your houses of prostitution, and you went to your games, and you ate more than you should, and you drank more than you should, and you vomited it out in the vomitorium, and you live these completely debauched lives. Don't do that anymore. Don't do what the Gentiles do. Don't practice what they practice. You need to get on being the person that God is calling you to be. So leave that old life behind. Be captivated by the vision of the human being that God is going to make you in the eternal age to come, and begin to focus on becoming that person and pursuing that kind of life. Then the second section, he gives four particular things he wants you to leave behind. Be angry at evil and injustice. Yes, you should be angry at evil and injustice, but don't sin. Dissolve your anger and fury in the truth. Allow the truth to mollify you as you wait for God to bring justice, and don't take it upon yourself. Don't steal. Rather, live your life committed to producing with your own hands good things for other people, that you might enhance the lives of other people through your labor. Make that your goal. Don't be ripping people off and taking what they have done. You produce and enhance the lives of other people. In the way you conduct yourselves and in what you say in your everyday conversation, don't be a fool. Don't be a fool who encourages foolhardiness in other people. Be wise and allow the wisdom in your life to just be evident in everything you say and in everything you do. And by so doing, allow that wisdom to, as he goes on to say, allow that wisdom that is evident in your life to show other people the wrongness of their ways, that they might be convicted of the wrongness of their ways. Don't be given over to rage and anger and quarreling, but be kind and compassionate. Emulate the kindness of God, who, when we were enemies, died for us, gave up his life for us. Be kind in that kind of way, instead of angry and argumentative. And then finally, put aside sexual immorality, and that's the last thing we talked about. But then he comes to the third section, and he says, what does all this come to? You're not darkness, you are light. And the light that he's talking about, light is not goodness, light is understanding. Light is the ability to see what reality is and be able to navigate reality because we can see what's there. We can see what's true. So you were darkness, but now in the Lord, he says, you are light. So walk as children of light. And then in the last paragraph, he said, do not share in common with them the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but in fact, rather show them that they are wrong. Now, how do we do that? Not by finger wagging and standing on the corner and accusing people of wrongdoing every time we see wrongdoing. Just live your lives in the light of the truth. And your life lived in the light of the truth will be showing them that they are wrong if they have the ability to see it all. They may not have the ability to see. Many will not have the ability to see. And that's why the nursery rhyme or whatever it is, wake up, sleepy head, get up from the dead, and the Messiah will be shining on you. That's what we're calling people to do, is Jesus has come into the world and shined the light of truth on all of human existence. It's there to be seen if we will but stop being dead, stop being unconscious, stop being insensitive to the truth, and pay attention to it. If we will but do that, then the light of Jesus' truth will shine on us. Okay, it's in the light of that then that he says what he says here in paragraph 30. So then, watch how meticulously you walk, not as wise men, but as unwise men, but as wise men, buying up the time because the days are evil. This is difficult to translate, and I'm not happy with my translation. In fact, I think I will change it. I won't be happy with this either, but I'll be less unhappy. I think I would translate it, so then watch how conscientiously you walk. I think that might actually be better. The point he's making is watch to make sure, be on the guard, be alert, to make sure that you walk, and that is conduct your life, conscientiously. Now, what does he have in mind? This word is used oftentimes in the context of investigating something and investigating it thoroughly and diligently and responsibly. You're seeking the truth. You're seeking the facts. You're seeking information. And when you do that diligently and responsibly and thoroughly, you arrive at the truth. And with the right kind of methods, you arrive at the truth. The word is used in that context. I think the way he means it here is every step that I take, every choice that I make, every word that comes out of my mouth, every attitude that I allow myself to have and every desire I allow myself to indulge in and every value that I embrace, do so intentionally. Don't be the kind of people who just drift through life, bobbing on the waves, being blown and sent in whichever way the currents are blowing. Don't be that kind of person. That's the fool. That's the unwise person. Be a wise person who seeks to have every moment of his life lived in the light of wisdom. The wise person is the one who seeks to have everything that he does, everything that he thinks, everything that he wants be wise and good and true. But to do that, you have to do it intentionally. That is, we can't just sort of, there's no inertia that's going to take us in the direction of that which is wise and good and true. We don't drift that way. The image I have is a bunch of those little yellow ducks that they dump in the river, dump those in the surf or dump those in the Columbia River. Willamette River is not big enough. You know, dump it in the Columbia River, the Mississippi River, or you're floating, you're a kid floating in a little plastic, what do you call those things? That you float on, floater things. And you're being swept quietly and strongly by this incredible current of this river. But your goal was to get to the other side, to that town on the other side. And, we say to each other, well, maybe we better start paddling. Ah, no, the sun's nice. The water's fine. It's just so wonderful here. You're going to be swept out to sea if you don't decide to deliberately make the effort to get to the other side, to your destination on the other side. And that's kind of where we're at, The days are evil, he said. What he's talking about is the culture around us, the world that we live in, the world that we're immersed in. These are evil days that we are dwelling in. And if we simply allow ourselves to be molded and shaped and directed by the currents of our culture, what's going to happen to us? We're going to be swept out into the sea of our own condemnation and destruction. We're going to be swept right along to our own death. But God has called us to get through this to the other side, to a particular destination, our eternal existence, where we are a new person, not the old person, but a new person. How are we going to arrive there? By striving to arrive there, by aiming at it, by going there, by deciding to be the person that God has called me to be. If I just drift, I will always inevitably die. I will be condemned and go to my destruction. So that's what's behind his exhortation here. So then, watch, be on the alert, be careful, be conscientious in how you walk. Or maybe I should translate it intentional. Watch that you walk intentionally, so that each step that you take is a step that you take because, to the best of your understanding, you're adopting the wise attitude or the wise choice, the wise action, the wise perception, or whatever. Because it's only by choosing wisdom that you avoid unwisdom, that you avoid being foolish. He describes it as buying up the time because the days are evil. What does he mean by that? I think what he's getting at is much along the lines of what I've just described. Every moment of every day is either going to be contributing toward my eternal well-being, contributing toward my eternal salvation, or not. And if not, it's wasted time. It's not really contributing anything positive to my existence. However much I may feel like it is or think that it is because I'm just following my passions and following my desires and following this and that around me that I think seems like it ought to be good, right? But it seems like it ought to be good because I don't even know who I am. I don't know who God created me to be. I'm a fool. I'm not wise. I don't have the knowledge and the understanding of what the purpose of my existence is, what the goal of my existence is, what will fulfill my existence, what will give substance to my existence rather than make it an empty, worthless shell of a thing. I don't know. I have to be taught that. And it's only when I am taught that by the light of Jesus shining on me that I now have the wisdom to know how I ought to live, what choices I ought to make. And when I don't have that wisdom and don't intentionally choose to invest every moment of my day in wisdom, I just waste my life. I'm wasting my time. So he describes us as intentionally deciding to pursue wisdom in order to buy up the time, to make sure that I'm not wasting it. I make it my own rather than have it just fritter away and not belong to anybody and be gone. Because the days are evil. If I'm not intentional, if I don't buy up the time and make sure that the next moment is working toward my well-being, my eternal well-being, then what I'm doing instead is pursuing evil. Why? Because the days are evil. They're going to mold me and shape me and determine the direction of my life. If I don't determine the direction of my life, the culture will. And so if I'm just a product of my culture, just on the current, the strong, quiet current of the culture, that it's going to take me where it's going to take me, and I can't do anything about it. It's only when I take steps to pursue wisdom that I can be wise. And then and only then am I buying up the time and not frittering it away and wasting it. So he says, because of this, that is, because the days are evil, I think, because of this, do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. If I allow myself to just simply float on the currents of the culture, I'm not going to get where I want to go, because I don't know what the will of the Lord is. It's only by knowing what the will of the Lord is and pursuing it that I am doing anything differently than just being molded and shaped by the evil days that I'm living in. Okay, then he's still making the same point, but from a slightly different nuance to it. Indeed, do not get drunk with wine, for that is a squandering of one's life. Rather, be filled by the Spirit so that you are expressing yourselves in spiritual psalms and hymns and songs as you sing and make melody in your heart to the Lord, by always giving thanks for all things to the God and Father in the name of our Lord Jesus the Messiah. Okay, he's talking about two things, and they are in contrast to each other. The first one is don't get drunk with wine, for that is squandering your life. Now, he's just told us that we need to buy up the time. Well, you're not buying up the time, you're wasting the time, you're squandering your life, you're squandering your existence if you get drunk on wine. I think the reason he's saying that is if you are drunk on wine, you cannot live conscientiously. Being drunk on wine is sort of giving up, is sort of impairing your judgment. And by impairing your judgment, you are in no position whatsoever to intentionally and conscientiously every moment of the day choose to do what's wise rather than what is unwise. We know what foolish things people do when they're drunk. What absolutely foolish, self-destructive, and idiotic things that they can do when they're drunk. They're not buying up the time during the period of their drunkenness. They're not buying up the time. They're not choosing wisdom rather than folly during the time that they are drunk. They're not making any progress toward becoming the person that they have been called to be by their Lord during the time that they're drunk. There's nothing happening except they might feel good, right? They might make themselves feel good, but what is that in the light of eternity, I think Paul would say, or is saying? What is that in the light of eternity? It's still wasted time. Because however much you might feel good, you haven't made any progress. You haven't learned wisdom. You haven't learned righteousness. You haven't become practiced at goodness during that time. You've just thrown that period of time away and said, oh, what the hell, I'll just, you know, whatever. So that's why he calls it squandering your life. So don't do that, he says. Rather, be filled by the Spirit. Okay, filled. I don't think he means filled with the Spirit. We're accustomed to thinking in those terms. We think of ourselves as containers and the Spirit of God as kind of filling us up. It's by the Spirit. It's the Spirit of God is filling us with something. Well, what is he filling us with? I think it's the counterpart to what someone who gets drunk on wine is after. A kind of delight, a kind of mellowness, a kind of feeling, a kind of joy. But the joy of wine is artificial. It's not grounded in reality. It's in place of reality. It's a kind of escape from a reality. It's not. There's nothing substantive about that joy because it's not grounded in anything. But the Spirit of God fills us with a kind of joy that is grounded in reality. Now, I'm not going to pretend that it feels as good as drunkenness. That's not the point. The point is it's substantive and it's real. Well, what's the joy he's talking about? Well, look at how he finishes. Be filled by the Spirit so that you are expressing yourselves in spiritual psalms and hymns and songs as you sing and make melody in your heart to the Lord by always giving thanks for all things to God and to the God and Father in the name of our Lord Jesus the Messiah. So what's the joy he's talking about? It's the joy that we experience in our tribulation. It's the joy that we experience all the time, no matter what circumstance we're in, whether it's good times or bad times, whether it's suffering or release from suffering. That there are all kinds of passages we could go to where we are in, what is it, James? Count it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Whatever that joy is that James is talking about, I think is exactly the joy that Paul is talking about here. He doesn't use the word joy, but I think that's in the background. There's a kind of joy that we get when we realize that no matter what is happening to me, God is producing a wonderful thing in me and giving to me a wonderful thing. I've probably said this before, but some of the most significant sensations in my life came in the midst of the greatest suffering in my life. Those times when I felt the deepest pain is when I felt loved the most by God. Because God had given me the perspective that I think Paul is recommending to us here. If we have wisdom, if we really understand what life is all about and who we are and who God is and what he's doing, what his purpose is, what his agenda is, if we really get what's happening, we realize that he wouldn't make me hurt like hell unless he loved me, unless he had made me his, and that he was right now, in this very moment, getting on with his project of sanctifying me, molding me, shaping me, deepening me, turning me into the man that he wanted me to become, making progress toward that eternal destiny that he had appointed me to from before the foundation of the world. Well, the assurance that you have that, oh, that's who I am, and it actually is happening right now. He really is doing this. You feel kind of special in an unusual kind of way. And so that's in the bad times. And then there are those good times where God blesses you in a particular kind of way, and you feel the loving touch of God, where God says, is saying, through circumstances, I love you. You're mine. You belong to me. That, too, reinforces that kind of joy. It's not an artificial high by altering your body chemistry. It's a high that is grounded in the actual objective reality of who you are in the eyes of God and in God's purposes. You can't get more real of a joy than that. So I think what Paul is doing is contrasting the artificial chemical high of drunkenness with the joy, the delight, the reward that comes from knowing who you are in the midst of life circumstances as God reveals that to you and as God works in your life, in the good times, in the bad times, in all circumstances. But you have to have wisdom to see that. So Paul is encouraging us to be wise and have wisdom rule the day, every moment of our lives. Now, I think what he's doing here, this passage has always confused me, because all of a sudden he starts talking about psalms and hymns and songs and so on. And every Bible teacher that I have ever heard, every commentary I've read, they think he's talking about psalms and songs. Because he says so, right? But let's pay attention to what he's saying here. Rather be filled by the Spirit, so that you are expressing yourselves in spiritual psalms and hymns and songs. So first of all, it's got this word spiritual in front of it. And I think what he means is, as distinct from literal, songs and psalms and hymns and so on. I'm not talking about real, actual songs, literally. I'm talking about spiritual psalms. As you sing and make melody in your heart to the Lord, right? Well, songs are not sung in the heart. We can talk about songs being sung from the heart, but songs are not sung in the heart. Songs are sung with the vocal cords. He's talking about a different kind of song, a song that's sung in the heart of a human being, not in the mouth of a human being. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I love songs. But that's not what he's talking about here. Okay, how do we sing songs in the heart? Well, he tells us, by always giving thanks for all things to the God and Father in the name of our Lord Jesus the Messiah. That inner attitude and the inner core of my being, an authentic gratitude toward God an authentic gratitude toward God, no matter what circumstances I find myself in, it's music to God's ears. It's praise to God. I am praising him with my very being, not with my mouth, not with a song, but with my very being. So as we would do in a worship service where we sing a song or a hymn or a psalm of praises to God for his glory and so on, that's all fine and good. But what replaces the being drunk with wine? What replaces the being drunk with wine is not belting out hymns, but rather having gratitude, authentic, genuine gratitude in our heart, in our deep core of our being. Okay. So you see what he's doing. What do I do when I'm drunk? Sorry to say, I've never been drunk, so I don't know what I would do, but If I hear tell, and I've seen it in the movies, that when someone gets drunk, they're inclined to belt out bar songs, right? So you go to an Irish pub, and what do? At the top of our lungs, we're all together in unison or in harmony, or who can tell when you're drunk, belting out songs to express, right, our good feelings. Our joy, this artificial chemical joy that we have, we're giving expression to that in literal songs. So what Paul is contrasting that with is, instead of belting out bar songs, let's have the quiet gratitude of our inner being be how we express praise to God and delight in who we are and what God is doing in my life. Express that delight and that joy in that deep inner gratitude toward God. That's what should replace that. And that's the counterpart to singing songs of praise to God in our worship service, except this is more authentic. Anyone can sing a hymn of praise to God. Only someone who is authentically wise can have that deep down inner gratitude toward God in any and all circumstances of their life. And that's the kind of hymn that we should be singing to God instead. Okay, let me pause there for questions or comments before we shift gears here.
Couple things, Jack. Just to build on that, I had never thought about it in this way, but there's a sense in which, and I'm drawing somewhat from like Kierkegaard's the concept of dread or anxiety, mm-hmm. which I think is that low level frequency that God has given all of us to try to figure things are not right, mm-hmm. right? So it just struck me as you were unpacking that with that alcohol can actually give an experience in which you feel like finally things are right, like the puzzle slips into place. So I wonder if that's part of it. Is that
good point?
But then what's great is that I think he's juxtaposing that against that. Really, that's the whole role of the Spirit is things are right. Like there's a when you have eyes to see, it's like there's this clarity which prompts the gratitude that you're talking about. That suddenly the angst is alleviated, but not in an artificial, temporary way, but in a substantive, meaningful way.
Right, right. Maybe not alleviated yet in that it removes the
correct,
basis of
right.
that, but it gives me the hope that I'm on a track to not have to be here.
Right, it's like being on a bridge looking down in the water, and for yeah. just a split second, the water is clear enough that you can actually exactly. see the bottom, and then it's gone.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, okay. But at least you got to see it for, yeah. okay. That was really helpful.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks.
Is there, off the top of your head, the verb for the buy back? Do you know where that's used elsewhere?
I don't believe anywhere.
Okay. I just thought that was an odd...
I can't trust my memory, but I think this is the only place it's used.
Okay, then my last thought was, in terms of the days being evil and the call to believers throughout the ages to resist that, one of the things I've been struggling with and thinking about is what does, like if we were to line up a believer from each of the last 21 centuries, culturally there would be just vastly different things that would actually in some ways be in conflict with each generation, right? Like, in other words, we do things today that would make people in the fourth century, just culturally, that aren't moral things.
Okay, okay.
And I'm trying to differentiate, like, what would be those core, I mean, I think I know your answer, but how do you separate the cultural implications that we just are part of because we are in the stream, to use your analogy.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are going to make their ways into our lives and our sensibilities and the way we see the world. And then there are those that would absolutely, we'd find ourselves among brothers and sisters mm-hmm. throughout the ages. Does that question make any sense?
Yeah, I think so. Although, yeah. I mean, we're going to come up across something here shortly where slavery, where Paul, and I want to talk a little bit about why he doesn't denounce slavery. So we'll talk about that. But there's an example of something that we recognize as not just different, it's immoral. In fact, I would argue slavery is one of the most immoral things that human beings have ever invented. I mean, you can't get much more immoral than slavery. And yet, the way he treats it is not the way we would be encouraged to treat it, and we need to talk about that. So down through the ages, Christians have had part of their lives things that are downright immoral as part of the institutions of their lives. So I don't know that we can measure ourselves against each other, because none of us have it right. So it has to be measured against something that is transcultural, that transcends all human culture altogether. And we just simply need to grow in wisdom to do that, to be able to get that vision of what is it exactly that God has called me to, that calls not just me, but my culture into question and challenges it and exposes it as being fundamentally evil and fundamentally wrong.
So that's the interesting thing that prompted my question, is there is a part of us, I mean, here's Paul is going along within the current of evil, in a sense, of the use of slavery in this case.
Well, but I'm going to argue, I think he knows good and well it's evil.
Okay.
That he's not fooled by that. But how does he deal with the fact that there is institutional evil in his day?
That's
what will be instructive to us, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
But no, I think some of the things that we do when we're bobbing along with our culture are just fashion, just culture, kind of innocuous, neither here nor there. But some of it is fundamentally evil. And more of it is evil than we are willing to give it credit for, I think. And that's what we need to appreciate, is that instead of excusing stuff, it's just, well, you know, I don't know how I can live in this world if I don't participate, or if I don't go along, or if I don't tolerate this, or if I don't accept this. Well, don't live in it then. You know, be odd, be different. I think a few weeks ago I said we should be less afraid of looking like Amish and just go for it. Just be Amish. You know what I mean? I don't mean literally be Amish, but be considered weird by the people around us in the same way that the Amish are.
And yet it would be, that's almost an easier track. Like, give me weird clothes to wear so I don't have to deal with the tension.
Yeah.
It
shouldn't be the less important things and trivial things. It should be the more substantive things that make us. Let me give you an example. Some of you may be aware of, there's a Southeast Asian American student at Berkeley this past week who had been elected to the Student Senate. And the Senate had a proposition that Trump had reversed something where, or had by executive order decided that for purposes of Title IX and all federal programs and so on and so forth, what your gender is going to be correspond to your biological sex. So he's basically calling into question the former administration's let people decide their own gender kind of thing. And his executive order reversed that. This young woman is a member of InterVarsity at Cal Berkeley, ran with a party on the platform that she was going to represent the Christian community at Berkeley, and was elected. I don't remember the name of her party, Student Action Party or something like that. The whole Senate, a bill was passed to try to basically object to Trump's executive order. And she abstained rather than voting for the proposition that objected to it. She didn't even vote no, she just abstained. And she has been crucified by the entire campus. Just absolutely crucified. And her own party she was asked to resign immediately. Her own party is kicking her out of the party because, and if you look at her statement that she made, I mean, it was wonderful. She emphasizes how God is a God of love and he loves all people no matter what, you know, what their choice is. And that's her position as well. And it's just that but because she's a Christian, she believes that God created marriage in a particular way and for the sexes and so on, and she can't in good conscience violate that, particularly given that she said that she was going to represent the Christian community on campus. But the fact that she is an absolutely delightful and wonderful person who means nobody any harm at all, she's a hateful bigot who needs to be hurt. I can't remember why I'm saying that. Okay. So I say more power to her. I mean, look how easy it would be to just go along and make life easier for yourself. But she could not, in good conscience, just go along. She had to make a statement that reflected what she actually believed, what the Bible actually teaches, our culture is going to just become more and more and more and more hostile to everything that we believe. I mean, I think you can count on it. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And those are the kinds of issues. It's not whether you wear a funny hat or don't use a telephone. It's on those really, really substantive issues. Are we willing to look really, not only in her case, not only odd, what we're going to be charged with is being hateful, being bigoted, being evil. We are evil. Because we are standing up for good, we are evil. So.
I think that's often in the mundane experience, day-to-day experiences of our lives where we're not confronted with that kind of a crossroads that she was.
Right.
It's even slipperier. Right? I mean, how do you know when you are being fully materialistic or idolatry? You know, those are the things like that, you know, or valuing things that just are not of God.
That's
it's just
right.
Much more elusive.
Right.
And those are the things that I think it's how do you strip away culture that can get very difficult. But I think ultimately I'm lobbing you a question that's like this should be like a 3-day conference.
Well, I don't think we can successfully do that. But I think what Paul is saying is try.
Sure, that's good. Yeah.
You know,
that's
to really live helpful. Intentionally is to realize the importance of doing the work, of doing as much of that as we can. Because we are fallen, evil people, we're not going to be completely successful. You know?
That's really good.
Yeah, just to piggyback on that, though, I mean, the frittering away of our days, it's never in... as far as I can see in history, been easier than now.
I'm sorry.
It's never been easier than now.
Yeah, yeah.
To fritter away our days.
Right.
It's just in our homes, accessible at all times to choose entertainment and relaxation and all those things that can be good in moderation and appropriate in moderation. But to, you know, it's something that our kids are being reared in the culture that's how you should spend your time. It's mm-hmm. tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point.
Hey, Jack. Does this capture what you're getting at with the last couple of verses? If you translated it, do not let it be that which fulfills you is wine. You know, the fruit of wine being forgetting, like Andrew was talking about, but let that which fulfills you be the Spirit. You know, the work of the Spirit in your own life towards sanctification, the work of the Spirit in the world. If that's what you find fulfillment in, then naturally you're going to be someone who rejoices at the work of the Spirit in your life and in the world?
Yeah, I think so. If I followed all that, we should be filled with the wisdom that leads to a substantive, real, and authentic kind of joy at what God is doing in my life and what he's accomplishing in my life. Yeah. Instead of being allowing myself to be distracted and forget I like what he was saying about the anguish of life. Instead of being distracted so that I don't have to confront the anguish of life, we instead have the joy of knowing what God is going to do in my life, knowing who I am.
So that I don't know if it's a verb or an adjective in this case in the Greek, filled.
Can it, participle, I believe.
Participle.
Yeah.
Can that, does that naturally contain the idea of being fulfilled?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think it's filled in that sense. I think it's we're filled with something, but I don't think he's telling us what we're filled with. We have to glean that from the context. So I think what we're filled with is a certain perspective, a certain understanding, a certain wisdom that leads to that grounds us in the reality of who we are before God and what God is doing in my life, such that I am brought to joy over that.
Thanks.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
So, Jack, you're taking to be filled with the Spirit not as a third being of the Trinity, Spirit, but wisdom in that sense?
Well, I think the Spirit is God. It's just God. It's God at work in my insides to give me eyes to see and ears to hear, give me a heart that understands, give me an inside that grasps what's going on and grasps the truth. So it leads to wisdom, but it's a wisdom that's born of the supernatural working of God himself in remaking me and in recreating me, which is what he's doing when he sanctifies me. He's rewiring my priorities and values and desires and so on and so forth. So it's called the Spirit because it's just a way of referring to God. God at work, God doing it. Yeah. Yeah, it's not the third person of the Trinity, but it is God that is being referred to.
So I'm going to pick up on what a number of people have said about, it seems like the contrast is wine is a way of distracting myself or medicating myself from the truth of reality. And the Spirit is the contrast is the Spirit is opening my eyes to reality, and from that I have gratitude, or the wisdom of the perspective of that brings gratitude to understanding what God is doing in the story that he's writing in my life in reality.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right. And that's why it's authentic and real, because he's grounding me in the reality of what he actually is doing.
When you talk about the joy you feel when you're feeling sorrow, and tragedy and grief and, you know, things that happen in our lives that are extremely tragic, like loss of life and property and those things, and losing friends, and secular people don't seem to have the same source that they can, you know, feel a joy from.
Right, right.
And the joy that always wells up in me has to do with what I know and what God has made me. And what he has prepared for me, because ultimately none of us are going to survive this existence.
Right.
And so where we have our hope is in that eternity that we've gained through Christ.
Absolutely.
So is that the same song? Are you singing that song? I mean, is that...
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And because... when I am made to suffer by God, I know how I fit into that scheme. I am one of those he's saving. I am one of those he has chosen. How do I know that? Because he loves me enough to hurt me. He loves me enough to hurt me with his surgery, with as he tries to shape me into the person. He's not just letting me drift away to destruction. He's going to sanctify me. And if he's going to sanctify me, sanctification hurts. But the fact that he's sanctifying me is evidence that I can take to heart and know who I am now. I'm a child of God. Before the foundation of the world, I'm one of those people he chose to take into eternity. So, yeah, exactly.
But Jack, do you think we do that to ourselves? I mean, when we're feeling that tragedy and that horrible loss in our lives that we're supposed to somehow feel joyful about, it seems to me that when I look back on my life, I wasn't capable. I was too engrossed in my feelings and the heartache. But it feels like it comes from God. I didn't seek it, but he gave it to me anyway.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Is like after I went through the feelings and I went through the tragedy, there was something else that brought me out of myself, I guess, in a way.
I mean, I think the actual map of my emotional map is we're not all going to have the same. There's all kinds of different things that are at play and that are influencing that and affecting that. And one of it is, how well do we understand? If I don't understand very well, I'm not going to immediately going into counting it joy when I'm encountering all sufferings. It may take the suffering to instruct me how I am supposed to even know who I am and what God is doing. I mean, it may take me in my pain. It may take me to the scripture looking for some answers. And then it may be only after the fact that I go, oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. That's he loves what I mean. Me, you know? It almost feels like we are incapable of
it. Sure.
It has to come because we belong to God.
Yeah, one way or the other, the light has to shine on me.
Right. And exactly. So because that, I think we get mixed up with the word joy, too, is that when you're in tragedy and things are going horrible, we're not going to be this happy-go-lucky. That's not the kind of joy we're talking about. That's deep. It has to come from, to me, I don't know, it just seems like it has to come from somewhere else because we're just human and we're incapable in those times.
Exactly. It's not the joy that is instead of pain. It's the joy that's deeper than the pain. Exactly. Okay. Let me just take a few brief moments to introduce us to the next section. We won't look at it until next week, but he now makes a break, and in section 2.4, we now have an exhortation, three exhortations to embrace your particular subordinate status in various social relationships, husband, wife, parent, child, master, slave. And in each and every one of those relationships, he's saying, if you have been placed in a subordinate status, accept it, embrace it, don't reject it. Now, why? What's going on here? Now, remember, we're in a context in Ephesians where we're talking about he's exhorting us to be righteous, to conduct ourselves in the life in a way that's righteous. So I think this is no exception to this. He's telling us that that's the righteous thing to do. The righteous thing to do is to embrace the subordinate social status that you find yourself in. Now, I think I have misunderstood this my entire Christian life, this next section. What's critical is that the critical thing is, what question is being answered in these passages? Let's just take the first one, wives be subordinate to your husbands. Usually our English translations translate it, wives submit to your husbands, I think, probably most of your English translations, which I'm going to argue is a very misleading and unfortunate translation. I don't think that's what he's saying. He's not saying wives submit to your husbands. He's saying wives accept your subordinate standing relative to your husband. We have been enculturated to go into this chapter thinking that the question being asked is, how should wives behave interpersonally in their marriages? How should children behave interpersonally in their relationship to their parents? How should slaves behave as slaves in relationship to the master? Well, that's why we translate it submit, because we think that's what is being answered is, how should I conduct myself? What should be my demeanor? What persona should I have? How should I do this, being a wife to a husband thing, or being a child to a parent thing, or being a slave to a master thing? I want to submit that that's not the question at all. That's not what he's addressing. What he's addressing is, rather, something that's in the background in Paul's culture. Let me take you to 1 Corinthians for a second, where it becomes clear that this is in the culture, at least in Corinth. This is chapter 7. I'm going to start reading about verse 17. Only as the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each, in this manner let him walk. Okay, we have to ask the question, assigned to what and called to what? Okay, well, let the context answer those. And so I direct, in all the churches, was any man called when he was already circumcised? He is not to become uncircumcised. Has anyone been called in uncircumcision? He is not to be circumcised. Okay, were you a Jew when you were called to be a disciple of Jesus? Then stay a Jew. God made you a Jew. He thought it was fine before. He thinks it's fine now. Just be a Jew. Were you a Gentile? That's okay. Who made you a Gentile? God did. If you were a Gentile when you became a follower of Jesus, stay a Gentile as a follower of Jesus. Becoming a follower of Jesus does not have to change everything about your life. That's the key to this whole section. Okay, circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing, but what matters is the keeping of the commandments of God. Each man must remain in that condition in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not worry about it. If you're able to become free, rather do that. Okay. For he who has called in the Lord, who was called in the Lord while a slave, is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. You are bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, each one is to remain with God in that condition in which he was called. Now, for those of you who lived through the Jesus movement, you know how many good rock and roll albums were destroyed when you became a believer, right? When did you like the Beatles when you were called? That's cool. They do some good stuff, right? There's a tendency when we think about how absolutely world-changing this relationship with our Lord is, we think everything's got to change. Everything's got to be different. Nothing should remain the same any longer. He's the Lord. If he's the Lord, no one else is going to be my master. Not my husband, not this master over here, not my parent. Nobody's going to have any kind of authority over me, because Jesus and Jesus alone is my authority. I mean, you feel how compelling that seems to you. Well, that seems to have been the spirit that in a certain current in the Christian community that was out there in the air. And I think that's what Paul's responding to. So he responds in the case of wives to husbands. Were you a wife to a husband when you were called to become a disciple of Jesus? And you were in a subordinate role to your husband, right? Enforced by your society. You had a subordinate role to him. Should you now not accept that role any longer? Should you not embrace that role? Should you renounce that role now that you're a believer? No, don't do that. I mean, notice how he starts this section. in awe of the Messiah, be subordinate to one another. And I think that flies right in the face of a kind of a contrary argument. Out of awe for the Messiah, I will be subordinate to no one. And he's turning that on his head. In awe of the Messiah, be subordinate to one another. You're not disrespecting Jesus by respecting your husband, wives. You're not disrespecting Jesus by respecting your parents, children. You're not disrespecting Jesus by respecting your master, slaves. In fact, what he's arguing instead is it's the right thing to do. It's honoring to your Lord, and it's the righteous thing to do to simply embrace the role that you were in when you were called to become a disciple. Go ahead and submit to that. But what, especially when it comes to, notice that the text, he goes on to say, wives, be subordinate to your husbands. Children, obey your parents. Slaves, obey your masters. But nowhere does he say, wives, obey your husbands. But I think what all three of them have in common is how he heads this whole thing. In awe of the Messiah, be subordinate to one another. In all three of these relationships, go ahead and accept your subordinate role. Does that have anything to say about how we should act? Well, it depends on the relationship. And notice how in much of our teaching, we conflate all three, and wives are often taught from this passage to become like children to their husbands or to become like slaves to their husbands. Because what, isn't this all the same, right? Isn't being subordinate to them, doesn't it look the same in all three relationships? No, of course not. It's your wife, dude, not your slave. It's your wife, not your child. It's your partner, not your child. And Paul is in no way negating that. He's not in any way instructing us about, he's not instructing wives about how to relate to their husbands, but he does instruct husbands about how to relate to their wives. Because he recognizes that in their superordinate role, they can abuse that role. And so what he says is, Jesus has a superordinate role over all of us. Did he like abuse it? Just because you have a superordinate role doesn't mean that you can do that you should act in any other way than the way that he did. And he loved sacrificially. So husbands, love your wives sacrificially. That's what you should be doing. So we'll talk more about that, but just you can stick that in your pipe and smoke it over the week. And it's a very different orientation to the passage coming up than the one that I had for years. I just assumed, like everyone taught me, that he's teaching us how we should conduct ourselves. But he's rather saying these are valid roles. Accept the validity of this role. That's the righteous thing to do. And you have no need to rebel against that. So I'll let you go.